everybody, and this is Keith Pannell, and welcome back to another Science Studio, a very special Science Studio this week. In the studio with me is co-host Russell Chianelli, and we're going to be talking about things leaving the solar system. There aren't many things, if any things, that have been man-made that have left the solar system. Maybe a few of Russell's wilder ideas are out there somewhere where they deserve to be. But let's just talk about the Voyager. You've all known that about 1977, Voyager was kicked off, I presume from Florida somewhere, went into deep space and is now out there free from, in theory at least, the effects of our sun. Well, there are reasons why this is important, but there are also particular reasons why that technology was successful. Because how do you power something which is outside of the impact of our sun? There are two people we're going to be talking to today that have a great deal to do with that. Russell, who are our guests?
We're very happy to have with us today on Science Studio two old friends and very accomplished physicists who developed that power system. And the first is Dr. Ben Abeles, and the second is Dr. George Cody. Ben, George, welcome to Science Studio, and congratulations on your long-time victory.
Well, hello there.
Thank you.
So let's start. We like to get the audience a little bit familiar with our guests, and so we'll start with Ben. Tell us, Ben, how did you become a physicist? What were those sort of moments when you were a younger person that said, this is the career for me?
I was a student at a high school in Czechoslovakia, and I was failing miserably. And then my parents sent me to England to save me my life from the German persecution. And so at some point I decided I really would like to make something of myself. And I started going to school and working as a waiter. And I got very interested in physics. And this is how I then finally was able to prove to myself that I'm not a failure. And after the war, I went back to Czechoslovakia, and I studied physics at the university.
So you didn't actually study very much in England. You were just a waiter that suddenly woke up and thought, well, waiting is terrible, but maybe physics would be better.
Exactly.
George, if we might just jump across to you, the other physicist here, George Cody, how did you become interested in physics?
Well, I went to high school that encouraged us to get involved in electrical engineering. And from that point, I went to Harvard as an undergraduate. And I discovered that I had three interests that I felt happy with, apart from all the other things I learned about American history and stuff like that. And the interests were, I very much enjoyed going on further in mathematics, not to the extreme case of being a mathematician, but taking the background courses that were supportive of engineering, electrical engineering, or physics, or chemistry, too. And I discovered that my real interest was in physics because it both I could learn something that I didn't really know, and that was something I wanted to do in the college. And I discovered that what I was learning excited all my curiosity at the same time. What was going on here? And I continued to take some advanced courses in my junior and senior year. And then at that particular time, I got interested, went to graduate school, and decided to do it at Harvard because I could get a scholarship that was supportive, which was helpful. And I found myself writing my PhD in a field called superconductivity, measuring an experimental field where I constructed apparatus, made the measurements, was strongly supported by...
What materials were you using in superconductivity?
We were looking at that time, I was looking at volume change when in the superconducting transition, and we were looking at anything that was a superconductor in liquid helium. That was before below 4.2 degrees.
Yeah. So you're following it since, and we still don't understand superconductors, even though they are a much higher temperature.
Yes, but it's the same connection, and I had to learn the Bardeen-Cooper-Schrieffer theory and differentiate things. What came out, to my surprise, is that my advisor who started me went back to Oxford, and the people at Princeton said, don't worry, and they assigned me an advisor who is one of the best experimentalists in the world to help on, because the person who started the program went back. And my advisor was someone who always says, have you ever thought of, he never told me what to do. But doing it, I ended up measuring the volume change associated with the superconducting transition and then could compare it to pressure measurements that my advisor, when he got back to Oxford, had made.
Well, let me ask you this question, and both of you guys had this long-standing interest in physics, and I guess you keep up with it. For example, this keeps me up at night all the time, quantum entanglement.
Right on. What I've always known is I could differentiate any quantum mechanical equation and turn it into an experiment. I don't do theories, I do experiments, and the experiment is designed to test the theory, to work from a theory, to find out if the theory is correct and applies in various areas.
For my side, I have really not been doing any more physics. I've been interested in languages, and I speak 5 languages, spend all my time trying to maintain them. So that's my effort, my method of keeping myself from my brain drying up.
Well, Ben, have you learned a new language? You say you're maintaining them. So the 5 languages.
I learned Spanish.
Ah, you're learning Spanish. Muy bien, señor. Muy bien.
Por supuesto.
let's get back to the real topic that I think the audience are really going to be interested in, and that is way back there in the 70s. You were both, I think, working for a private company.
At a research lab.
Yeah, RCA.
Right.
RCA.
Yeah, how did you get to RCA, you guys?
Well, I got to RCA when I was working in Israel. I got my PhD at the Hebrew University. I did some work on germanium, which at the time was the workhorse of the newly discovered transistor. And I gave a talk in Amsterdam, the International Conference on Semiconductors. And there I met Frank Herman, who was at RCA at the time, and he invited me there for a postdoc. So that's how I got to RCA.
So it was, in fact, your joint work, gentlemen, on germanium and silicon.
Well, yes, I just wanted to point out that my route was very similar to Ben's. At Harvard, I met a person named Henry Summers who had graduated with a PhD from Harvard and was working at RCA, and he persuaded me to go. He said they would be really interested in the superconducting work that you had been doing and try them out and compare them to other places. When I went there, I discovered it was a very integrated laboratory where you had chemists, physicists, electrical engineers, and they all kind of did something that was important for themselves.
Right, the famed interdisciplinary research program.
But on the other hand, they had a rule that they would help everybody else in their research. So you could go around and ask anybody anything.
Right.
And they wouldn't answer immediately, but you could talk to them if you had questions.
Well, let's get on to these radioactive thermoelectric generators. That's what's really powering Voyager as it's out there beyond the impact of the sun.
All the deep space probes, all of them, Cassini, Voyager, everything in sight is powered by that.
So when you were beginning your research in the area, what were you thinking was going to be the utility?
I just want to say something. I thought that I was going to work in superconductivity at RCA, and which I did in about 4 years later. But actually, what came across for me, and I think for Ben, is that there was an urgent need to obtain and find what is the best thermoelectric power generator because of a deep space probe that was being planned, SNAP 10A, as the first one in 4 years from 1961. So I think we both worked together, identified what the problem was, in determining what's a good material, and discovered what was the best.
And tell us, how does it work? It's associated with temperature variation.
Yes.
But how exactly does the process work, in lay terms, if you would?
Well,
if you could.
You make a circuit out of an N-type and a P-type semiconductor, and you heat one junction and keep the other one cool, and you get an electric current flowing. And this is direct conversion of heat into electricity.
So it's a thermoelectric material with a delta T. If you have the right material, one end is hot, the other end is cold, you get electricity.
Yeah, and
the hot temperature is
1,000 degrees centigrade.
Okay, 1,000 degrees centigrade, and that's pretty difficult to get in space because we know it's cold, but we need to get to 1,000 degrees, and so how did you get to the 1,000 degrees?
Six pounds of plutonium.
Now, that's interesting.
Six pounds.
Right, I remember we did a program a long time ago with the late Edward Teller, and he was cracking on about these people that don't like nuclear energy, and he said, well, all we've got to do is just blast all the nuclear waste out into space. And in fact, I think he had a company that he was dickering with in Hungary that would do this. How many pounds did you say of plutonium?
Nowadays, it's 6 pounds.
Six pounds.
The material is something like 15% efficient, converting that into power.
And when I think about it, 6 pounds, you need a lot more for a bomb, don't you?
Oh, definitely. But on the other hand, from our invention in 1961, in 1964, SNAP 10A was sent to the above the Earth, which was a reactor. It demonstrated that it worked. Now, it wasn't just the lab that did this. It was RCA's Camden facility and working.
Now, let's go to Ben for a moment then. Ben, when you were working on this and you were thinking about the whole concept of extraterrestrial vehicles, how excited did you get by the application? Or were you really, really concentrating on the
widget? Keeping your job.
Well, we were very excited by this possibility. And our main contribution at the time really was that we learned how to measure thermal conductivity at a very elevated temperature, because under those conditions, radiation overtakes everything, and all the measurements that were made until then were very inaccurate.
Off by factors of almost 10.
And no, so we used a technique that was first used by a fellow called Angstrom in 1834, thereabouts, and what he did, he took the material and he put a variable temperature at one end, and then he measured how the heat wave is propagated along the road. And by doing that, he's able to eliminate completely radiation losses. And we applied this to the semiconductors, and we found that the material, this germanium silicon, which other people had measured previously, including our boss and including the Soviet Union, the values were much lower than thermal conductivity that were previously thought of.
And it survived happily to 1,000 degrees centigrade.
So in other words, basically your measurements, which corrected everything, allowed you to go forward and make this device. Otherwise, it would have been ignored because the data out there was wrong.
Right. And I had a graduate student, Roger Cohen, put together this device. And when we tested it, we got 5% efficiency. But when the photographer came to record this historic event, by that time the device burned out. And he brought a little fan along. And so we couldn't run it. So I said, well, don't worry, just blow on the fan. And this is a picture which appeared in the New York Times, but never told them that we blew on the fan. Roger Cohen, after he had this terrible experience of working with me, decided to go into theory.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Kinelli. We've got two guests today, one all the way from England at the moment, Ben Avalis, and then George Cody from Princeton up there in New Jersey. Two physicists. We're talking about the Voyager. We'll come back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. A new street drug from Russia has arrived in America and is dubbed the worst drug in the world.
Called Crocodile with a K, it's named after the greenish, scaling, rotting skin where people inject the concoction.
Crocodile's chemical name is desomorphine and was first created in the U.S. in the 1930s as a possible substitute for the highly addictive morphine, but it turned out to be even more addictive. As many as 1 million Russians are now addicts, partly because it's easy and cheap to make.
It comes from cooking codeine with gasoline, paint thinner, lighter fluid, and a few other easily available ingredients in just 1 hour. Once injected into a vein, the user feels a high within 2 minutes, and the effects last up to 2 hours.
From the first dose, addicts can die within 2 to 3 years. Even once can be fatal since the drug is so corrosive. It can destroy veins, blocking blood flow.
If the drug isn't injected correctly into the vein, the skin begins to rot and degenerate to the bone, usually on the arms and legs, requiring amputation. The few addicts who recover are usually disfigured and brain damaged for life.
The first two known cases of crocodile use in the U.S. were documented by a poison control center in Phoenix, Arizona in September of 2013. Then additional reports came from Oklahoma, Illinois, Arizona, Utah, and maybe even New York City.
Crocodile is also confirmed in several European countries, such as Germany and Belgium. Some buyers of heroin may be unaware they're getting a cheaper and much more toxic drug. And since addiction happens in just days, we may be seeing just the beginning of this drug in the U.S.
We are Drs. David Meisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chinelli, Ben Avalis in England, George Cody in Princeton. These are the two physicists that hold the patent for these remarkable machines that will transform heat difference from one side of a semiconductor to another and generate electricity. So tell us both, gentlemen. We'll start again with Ben. Have you been following the Voyager? Are you sort of really fascinated by what's going to be learned in the next 10, 20 years?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, every time I'm excited by this, it's like any new discovery, it's like you invested in some stock and you're getting a dividend back.
Right. But for 30 years, didn't you worry it was going to break down sometime?
Well, we worried about it when we first invented it, that our results were overblown, and that we reported. It turned out when people in the manufacturing reproduced them, they got even better results than we have. So we were pretty confident this is going to work out.
And George, are you still following this, the Voyager voyage?
Yes, and I give talks to various places, like New Jersey Institute, the science group in New Jersey, about the long-term payoff of good research. And there's no question about it that this is unbelievable payoff, because the research was done in 1961. It was launched into outer space in 1964 with the SNAP 10A, and it's continued. Now, RCA sold it to General Electric, and it sold the patents due to General Electric, so that's the manufacturer today.
But it's the same technology that's being put on any spacecraft, correct?
Yes.
So it's not. There's not been a new technology since 1960s?
No.
Well, that's interesting, because there aren't many areas of science and technology where you can say that's the case.
Yeah,
so were you just extremely lucky or very perceptive?
Silicon germanium was very friendly. It does not get affected at 1,000 degrees centigrade.
And but then you want to...
In fact, the germanium silicon alloys were already worked on by guy called Herb Kramer, who got the Nobel Prize for a new drift transistor, but they never managed to succeed it on the germanium silicon, so it was just lying around there, and we got our hands on it.
Because all
it's kind of called serendipity. Mm-hmm.
All the materials that we were supposed to look at, when we put it in other materials, not silicon germanium, they would melt before you even got to 1,000 degrees centigrade.
You know, one of the research areas that I'm involved is, I'm in organometallic chemistry, and most of my work is on germanium and silicon, which is, from a chemical point of view, in fact, we measured the very first bond length between a silicon and an atom and a germanium atom. Very unuseful information, I must say, but I'm with you on these two elements. I think they're great.
And then I wanted to mention that in 1963, you won the David Sarnoff Outstanding Team Award in Science for doing this work with a bunch of other people at RCA.
Yes, after the patent had been issued, they could do that, because this was a very secret kind of thing.
Yeah, you can't get a prize for work that no one knows what you've done, right?
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about how you foresee, this is a big sort of change in topic, but we're talking about going into space. And you know, you read lots of science fiction, but you read, you know, really quite interesting scientific people talking about the possibility of migration of the human species from our planet Earth to other places. Give me your take on this, either one of you. Let's start again with Ben.
Well, I haven't been thinking about it too much. We have so many problems right down here on Earth that this seems like a far-fetched idea, going into space and living there. We don't seem to be able to live even on this Earth properly.
Well, let's be more mundane.
Technology stimulates other technology if there's a thrust in the direction. Just like the silicon germanium thermoelectric power generator is much more efficient than it was when it started out. And you can look it up at Wikipedia if you want. And nobody ever wanted to talk about the plutonium, so it was kind of hidden.
Well, in fact, that's correct. I mean, there are certain topics, even amongst scientists, where they seem rather loath to get out front and lead the public, because I don't know why. I mean, I don't know why more people don't talk about. Both Russ and I are, in fact, I think, in favor of a lot of more research and energy coming from nuclear processes.
Yeah.
Yes. But you couldn't do that. We got Inventors Awards in 1991 that were independent, a Ballantine Medal and an Invention Award for that, because of the Voyager being. We were invited to the Voyager takeoff. We saw it together.
What have we learned since the Voyagers has learned about outside the solar system? I know there was some things I was reading about a different magnetic field as when you got out of the solar system, but what are we learning?
Well, my son is a geochemist at Carnegie Institute, and I learned from him that all the carbon on the Earth came in a meteor like 65 million years ago or something like that. And so you're learning something about the fact that our Earth is not unique. Our solar system is not unique.
Yeah, but I mean, we're getting data that's coming directly back from the Voyager, and I was reading something about this. I forget what the right word is, but there's a different magnetic atmosphere as soon as you move outside, and people are arguing about that.
The density of the particles has a sharp change, and I don't remember, but I think it's a big drop in the
less dense.
Well, the idea is once you get out, escape away from the influence of the sun, then it's the cosmic rays which are really predominant, and therefore that's in fact how people have, at least as far as I can understand it, have been able to say, yes, indeed, finally, Voyager is out there in deep space.
That's correct.
And I was thinking that to say that the generation of from carbohydrates to human beings could occur anywhere. And human beings seem to have a unique brain ability, and so it's quite possible that there's somebody else out there.
Well, I mean, just on a more mundane level again, both Russ and I have made predictions for several years that sooner or later on Mars or somewhere close, we're going to find some evidence for life form, probably bacteria. I mean, would you sort of go along with that? That's your sort of scientific expectation?
It's mine.
Yes.
Well, so far, as far as I know, the Curiosity rover, which uses the battery which we invented, found no trace of water.
No trace of water on Mars, yeah. But now I'm reading that there is more evidence that there might have been in the past.
Yes, that's what I've been reading, too.
Well, I thought, in fact, let me get this right, because Russell's always crapping on about Mars warming, and therefore if Mars is warming, global warming here has got nothing to do with hydrocarbons. and I thought that the poles in Mars were, in fact, a lot of water. Am I wrong on that?
Well, I would correct myself. They found no evidence of life.
Ah, yes, that's right. But, I mean, there's plenty of water on Mars, as I know it.
You know, there's another application for the silicon germanium thermoelectric power generators. It powers submarines as well.
Well, but you need the plutonium nuclear reactor in order to get to the temperature that you need in order for the thing to operate.
But the submarines like it because it's quiet, so nobody can hear them under the water.
Right.
when we're talking about what we know about the universe and so on, we really don't know as much as we think we do.
Yes.
And so we think about dark matter, dark energy, the universe is expanding. There's no such thing as a contraction and expansion. Like when I was in school, that was all figured out. It exploded, contracted, exploded, you know, forever. But now it looks to me like it's expanding forever. So what do you guys, let me start with Ben, what do you think about that?
Well, it's very interesting, and it's the result of dark matter that
yes.
people don't know much about yet. I mean, they've detected that it is expanding at an accelerated rate, and the cause for it is dark matter, but this is still a big mystery.
I discovered that maybe about 10 years ago, people were talking about carbon was in our universe because of the Big Bang and because of a certain numeric number for the fine structure constant. Now that we're getting this black matter and black stuff pulling us out, all those ideas have been dropped, and people kind of just assume carbon is a natural thing coming out.
The carbon is just everywhere, and you know, all the speculation about it coming in on a meteorite or something like that, but there are fusion reactions in the suns that make carbon, no?
Yeah, but anyway, the thing coming from the Big Bang, there was a big argument with Hoyle and other people like that about saying the fine structure constant should be 1 over 137, or otherwise we wouldn't have carbon. And that struck everyone as wild. And now you can't even find it if you look for it now. They're kind of, yes, making the assumption that you've just made, Russ.
That it's just coming from, it's just natural.
It's a natural thing from the Big Bang generation of solar system.
I'd never heard that business about this constant.
I'm younger
than Russell. And so I've just assumed all these elements came from fusion processes and condensations. Look, we're running out of time.
Okay.
Ben and George, you're so tied together in your research, your history. How often do you get together and have a good drink, or do you not see each other very often?
Well, we see each other about once a year. But
he's
also done a lot of backpacking in the Adirondacks together. And rock climbing in the Schwangungs.
Yeah, we climbed all the mountains together for about and took all our children, and they wanted to come, so they came with us.
And they used to have M&Ms, and we called it munching and marching.
One thing I want to ask finally, too, Ben, weren't you involved in starting a soup kitchen in Trenton?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
For poor
people?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was not in setting it up, but I helped them with the internet and setting up the database, and I brought an old Mac computer there and started teaching computers. And, of course, this has grown quite a bit.
Well, I think that's a wonderful accomplishment. I make a contribution there, and it's going along very healthy, and I'm really very happy to have this chance. We could talk forever about these things. But thank you very much for being on The Science Studio.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah, Ben Abelis in England, George Cody, two physicists that when they worked for RCA used germanium and silicon to make these little power generators that are taking all these things into space and submarines under the water. Ben, George, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And Norman Martinez, thank you for putting the program together. And we'd like to thank the audience for listening. We'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. The Medical Center of the Americas Foundation has launched a capital campaign to support construction of El Paso's first ever biomedical research building. The $37 million facility will be the first structure on El Paso's first biotech park, also being developed by the MCA Foundation. Read more at mcasynapse.org. Support for Synapse comes from Kindred, a transitional care hospital.